papers recently had places where they told us that it was much better to watch our genetics.
Sure it is. They just say if you don't, you're through.
Well, then isn't that an answer?
Sure it is. The problem is to be practical today, Helena. What can you sell today? What idea can you put across in the middle of the 20th century? I'm not interested in highfalutin theories of 500 years from now.
In Japan, haven't they done, I read somewhere they've done something about that sterilization of men, but they...
I don't know.
The state would do it for nothing if they, after they had so many children?
I think this is an effort to handle birth control. There is a conspiracy going on in Puerto Rico, which is Roman Catholic. The medical profession are sterilizing all females after the fourth child, if they're in a hospital. They're just arbitrarily doing it as a birth control technique.
Does the
Catholic
Church know about it? Yeah, but remember, these are Latin American males who send their women to church. They don't go personally. This is a conspiracy on the part of the medical profession. You see, here, before we go back to how we get off this planet, here's the problem. Here's the paradox of civilization. Might does not make right, but might does make what has been and now is. The problem is, how do you attach might to the service of right? Until you make that attachment, you're living in a dream. You're on Pink Cloud 42. Another example of the same problem. We should love our fellow men. We should be kind to them. They're the boss's kids. He loves them. There's one attitude. The other side of the coin. If you let the inferior human strains multiply enough, and remember, that reduces mind potential, and in the long run, spirit receptivity. And if you restrict the multiplication of normal to better than average strains enough, this means you are cutting down the potential for brain power and spirit receptivity in society. And if you get real sentimental and unscientific in your attitude of affection for your fellow man, you are dooming your civilization to destruction. Because pretty soon there isn't enough brains to keep the show on the road. And she goes kaput. I think this basically is why Rome went down. The term proletariat originally was used in upper crust Roman society, and it meant the bearers of the next generation. And if you run out of brains, you're going to run out of civilization. So you've got to balance your Christian sentimentality on the one hand with an understanding of scientific law on the other. Because until you reconcile your religious attitude of brotherhood to the hard-boiled facts of genetics, you are not going to succeed. And there's no use closing your eyes to these hard-boiled facts. They're here, and if you don't go with them, they will whip you. There's another paradox.
Somewhere the papers say that it is the people that make civilization, not civilization that makes the people.
Quite right. You've got two standards of measurement in the universe. If you love God, that's all He wants. You accept sonship. But the Supreme Being has a different standard. He wants you to pay off. He wants you to do something. And there's the presentation of the age-old controversy of faith and works. It's not one or the other. It starts with faith and then produce, if you have the ability. Yes?
I think I heard in Chicago, one of the meetings, that, in fact, I'm not sure, but I think your dad might have said it, God gave us the ability to create children, the mind to do it.
the well,
not to do it half-heartedly.
That's right. That's right. I have never felt that. I've never felt that we should breed like rabbits.
Some people do.
Yeah. You asked me to run a forecast of the next 10 years. Would you like the science fiction a little bit? This little plot would make a good science fiction story. It was hatched up on the way to California on one of the trips. I was coming out here with Sandy Wall. And he's a pretty brilliant engineer, and incidentally the spark plug of my group in Connecticut. And Sandy was talking about his visualization of the manufacturing developments of the future, and I was adding to it my visualization of the reactions of human nature, and here's the story. Don't take this seriously. But we've worked very hard, and let's fictionize for a little bit. Sandy feels that it's within the range of the power of technology. We're not going to the moon now. This is all going to take place on Earth. To produce robot-like machines of increasing complexity and versatility, which will displace workers right on the production line, and which will have increasingly built-in feedback circuits so that they can discriminate and even turn on a red light which says, help, help, I'm in trouble. I've hit something I can't solve. This is going to result in a tremendous diminution of the demands of working hours. I don't think Mr. Hoffa and Mr. Ruther are going to let industry cash in on very much of these gains. The work week could slide down to 20 hours, to 18 hours, with an actual increase in take-home pay. And now we've got a problem. We have leisure without culture. And let's just add a couple of more real lethal ingredients. Number one, lots of alcohol. Number two, oral contraceptives. You take a pill, no pregnancy. Number three, even more potent antibiotics. No fear of any venereal infection or whatnot. And I can see a real lost weekend. This is going to make the Roman Saturnalia look like a piker. I was telling this to one of my friends who's about 65. He said, God, I wish I weren't so old. Now what happens when the human race comes off this big jag? This is no different than what Arnold Toynbee points out is challenge and response. I think when we wake up on the morrow of this tremendous lost weekend, which may be a lost decade and may be a lost generation, I think we will, this to me could happen. I think we are going to set a new pattern for human beings. Because who will be the biologic survivors of this time of sociological troubles, to use Toynbee's expressions? It's a cinch that we will have permanently divorced procreation from passion, won't we? Up until now, the human race has operated on, well, here's the qualifications for the fathers and mothers of mankind. Papa was a successful hunter of both meat and women. This is not very nice, but it's a fact. He succeeded in hunting meat, and he succeeded in hunting women. And Mama at least made sure she did not outrun Papa. She got caught, and she loved babies. Those women who didn't love babies are not the mothers of the human race. Those men who hunted meat only are not the fathers of the human race. But after this lost weekend, or lost generation, the people who would be alive on Earth when this generation passed would be there for a new reason. Because Papa and Mama wanted children. And all of a sudden, the more tender parental emotion would become the prime factor in biologic survival for the first time on Earth. This has never been true up until now. This is partially true today. I think that out of this, oh my Lord, moral, ethical, sociological holocaust, which Sandy and I cooked up on the Super Chief, we could emerge with a far finer human race than the world has ever seen. Yes, Ruth?
How general over all the inhabitants of the world could that probably be?
Probably not. We're talking about the United States of America, and we're assuming that no one takes advantage of us in our drunken stupor. It's hard enough to spin that tale for this country. Isn't that a horrid thought? But I talked to a manufacturing friend of mine. He runs a flat steel plant in New Jersey. And we were discussing this very problem as of about 2 years ago when their plant was running at overtime capacity. And some of their union members were making simply fantastic sums of money. And I said, Johnny, where does it go? And Johnny says, thank God for the bookies. He said, if it wasn't for horse races, these people would be ruined. But he said, they're losing enough money on horse races so that they have to keep working. And he says, much better they lose this money gambling than spend it on booze. I don't think I ever quite appreciated the value of bookies before. But they are able to siphon off these earnings, which these folks have not got culture enough to use wisely and brains enough to put in the savings bank. They're going to spend it. And if they lose it gambling, they're not hurt in any other way. This isn't very Pollyannish, is it? But by gollies, this is real. This goes on. Question, Mary.
Could this really happen in the life that, while more than this was our country we were talking about, during this period of so-called debauchery, the nation itself would be so weakened that a stronger nation would take them over before they could survive
Quite right.
And establish this new regime?
You're entirely right, Mary. Quite right.
Meanwhile,
quite
China.
Right. Here, I would symbolize it this way. The Spartans whipped the Athenians, but the Athenians at least fought. The Corinthians didn't even fight. What I'm describing is Corinth now. And Corinth was famous for its commerce and its courtesans.
Well, the nation is only as famous as its individuals.
Right.
If the individuals got to this point that you suggested, then the nation would be...
My story won't come true for the very reason you point out.
Then on page 18... dealing with crime on the neighboring planet.
Yes, they move in pretty fast.
It says here, the more serious habitual criminals and the incurably insane are sentenced to death in local chambers.
Yes.
they must have some means of determining whether they're incurably insane.
I think they probably make a few mistakes, Paul.
And they do.
And probably the judges of the higher universe rectify those. This guy wasn't curably insane, and so he survives.
I think that we're so far behind most people. Mm-hmm. Well, you shame yourself.
Sure we are.
I'm coming in favor of living away from the society.
How about a coffee break? Then we'll go back to how we get off a planet. After the twins took off on their flight, there arrived on this world the Nebadon Archangel of initial planetary circuit establishment. And the life carriers gathered around the planetary pole of space communication and got their first message from Salvington. And from the chief of the Archangel Corps, transmitting greetings and acknowledging that man had evolved on Urantia. And then they got greetings from the Most Highs of Edentia. And Then they got greetings from Lucifer. Paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. The finest description, simple description, of what man has to do and of the help he can expect to receive. The life carriers were just busting their buttons to help these twins. But they could not help the twins until the twins decided to flee. And when the twins decided to flee, then the life carriers could add to that decision the feeling northward. You see, the twins didn't know geography. And it was very necessary that they flee in the right direction. And they were faced with a decision of prime magnitude beyond their capabilities. And so they were required to do what they could do, and they were given what they couldn't do. Upon the decision to flee, the life carrier superimposed the feeling northward. I think that is the clearest exposition of the interrelationship of human mind and human decision and divine help. Helena?
That
never happened before, and it never happened since. This experience is unique on this world. And I just think that's a wonderful paragraph. The twins decided to flee, and the life carriers helped them decide the right direction. But you can't give direction until you've decided to flee. You can't be helped in many ways until you have made a decision. You know, in many practical ways, there's an old-timey hymn, I guess, that's built around this. But I just love the homely philosophy that's told in the rather corny story of the Tennessee mountaineer that's on this narrow trail. And as he rounds a sharp bend, he sees a bear, and he pulls back quickly. And being a devout man, sinks down to his knees to pray. And he says, "Dear Lord, thou knowest all things, hence perceive the fix I'm in, and I do ask for help. However, if it be not in the divine wisdom to help me, please don't help the bar. Just stand by and watch the gall darnedest fight you ever saw." To me, that's a very legitimate prayer. Fairly sound, practical philosophy. Always seek for the simplest explanation of what happens. I can believe that just purely human imagination could have worked this one out. Always be open-minded. This is my philosophy of life. As you look back in life, you see lots of things that appear to be more than chance. And gee, I think we should be open-minded. We should always ask the question, was this more than chance? But you know something? I really don't think we should try to answer that question. When Jesus went down to Jerusalem, he bumped into Gained and Gonad. And the papers use the specific term, "This meeting took place by apparent chance." And here's what that expression means to me. The midwayers have done an FBI investigation on this, and they can't find any piano wires. But they're suspicious. Too much good came out of this meeting. It couldn't have been chance, but as far as they can determine, it was chance. And you know, there are wheels within wheels. To us, the midwayers can do mysterious things. The secondary midwayers scared the literal bejesus out of the guards around the tomb when they rolled that stone away, you know? And I mean, these Romans and Jewish temple guards really took off on the double for Jerusalem. But I think that there are things that happen on this world that are just as mysterious to the midwayers as to us. May I give an example of Wheels Within Wheels?
I think I can find it. Page 1201. Destiny of Personalized Adjusters. First of all, on paragraph 3, they state that they are the personalized adjusters are the untrammeled, unassigned, and sovereign stabilizers and compensators of the far-flung universe of universes. They combine the creator and creature experience, existential and experiential. They are conjoint time and eternity beings. They associate the pre-personal and the personal in universe administration. Of course they would, obviously. They remember when they were pre-personal and now they have personality. Personalized adjusters are the all-wise and powerful executives of the architects of the master universe. They are the personal agents of the full ministry of the Universal Father. Personal, pre-personal, and super-personal. Remember our discussion in the foreword? These are the three levels on which God functions. And they all converge in the thought adjuster. They are the personal ministers of the extraordinary, the unusual, and the unexpected throughout all the realms of the transcendental absonite spheres of the domain of God the Ultimate, even to the levels of God the Ultimate, God the Absolute. Now, hang on to this a second.
What page, Bill?
We're on page 1201. And I think I can find what I'm looking for. On page 1305, hang on to 1201, we're coming back there. They're discussing about how don't count on too much other than justice and the operation of providence. In other words, it's the function of the Trinity and the Supreme Being, and it deals with a total. And on the second paragraph, on page 1305, they warn you that one-eyed jacks may be wild in this deal, even though they usually aren't. And they say, nevertheless, the Father, as a person, may at any time interpose a fatherly hand in the stream of cosmic events, all in accordance with the will of God, and in consonance with the wisdom of God, and as motivated by the love of God. And I think the hand which the Father interposes in the stream of cosmic events would likely be a personalized adjuster. Let's read on. These personalized adjusters are the exclusive beings of the universes who embrace within their being all the known relationships of personality. They are omnipersonal. They are before personality, pre-personal. They are personality, endowed by the Father. And they are after personality, super-personal, as in the life of eventuated transcendental beings. They minister the personality of the Universal Father as in the eternal past, the eternal present, and the eternal future. Seldom are the personalized adjusters seen at large in the universe. Occasionally they consult with the Ancients of Days, and sometimes the personalized adjusters of the sevenfold Creator Sons come to the headquarters worlds of the constellations to confer with the Verandadec rulers. And this next paragraph is the one I'm leading into. You know that on this world we have what we have in residence, a Verandadec son. Same order as rules the constellations. He's here as an observer. At any time in his judgment that he thinks it's necessary, he can, in effect, walk into the presence of the resident governor general and say, I'm taking over. He supersedes the resident governor general. And this is the inauguration of a Verandadec regency on the planet. And he is the boss. These regencies are of limited duration. Now let's read. When the planetary Veronidic observer of Urantia, the Most High Custodian, who not long since assumed an emergency regency on your world, asserted his authority in the presence of the resident Governor General, he began his emergency administration of Urantia with a full staff of his own choosing. He immediately assigned to all his associates and assistants their planetary duties. But he did not choose the three personalized adjusters who appeared in his presence the instant he assumed his regency. He did not even know they would thus appear, for they did not so manifest their divine presence at the time of a previous regency. And the Most High Regent did not assign service or designate duties for these volunteer personalized adjusters. Nevertheless, these three omnipersonal beings were among the most active of the numerous orders of celestial beings then serving on Urantia. In other words, at the time of this regency, I would assume that the architects of the Master Universe took cognizance of some problems and dispatched three beings who are described as their all-wise and powerful executives. Personalized adjusters are the all-wise and powerful executives of the architects of the Master Universe. We don't know how a midwayer would plan and think. Even a secondary midwayer, 37,000 years old, much less a primary. I don't believe that the midwayers altogether understand the plans of a Veronidic son, who is very much, who is altogether older. These Veronidic sons are among the oldest natives in the local universe. Gee, they must, well, Michael was here 400 billion years ago. The oldest inhabited worlds date from 200 billion years ago. I would say that the orders of local universe sonship might have an age intermediate between those two dates. If you ask me to guess, I would say the Melchizedeks, Veronidics, Lenonidics are about 300 billion years of age. This is an awful lot older than the midwayer, isn't it? All right, and here's another level. I don't think this Veronidic region had any idea what these personalized adjusters were up to, because they're executing the mandates of the second level of the firehouse. They are taking a transcendent time view of the problems of this work. Let's read. Level of the Architects of the Master Universe, the Super Universe level, page 351. This level embraces the seven Master Architects of the seven Super Universes, who now as a group spend about equal time in the company of the seven Master Spirits on Paradise and with the seven Supreme Executives on the seven special worlds of the Infinite Spirit. They are the Super Coordinators of the Grand Universe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're still at work.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You see, Ruth, here's the way I view it. The Ancients of Days, the Creator Sons, are primarily concerned with the seven super universes in terms of their finite evolution. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the absonite development of these areas is being foreshadowed, and the architects continue to function in terms of the problems of today which pertain to the ages of the future. And these future ages sometimes cast their shadow across the terrain of today's experience.
Mm-hmm.
Midsoniders, I think, really belong to the next universe age. Some of these creature, well, the creature trinitized sons of destiny definitely do. Some of the events of today are, in terms of this universe age, no more than seeds. The flowering is as of the next universe age, but the seeds are present today.
Is that part of the supreme growing, or what?
That's part of the ultimate growing. Oh. Remember, God the ultimate is growing now, along with God the Supreme, but is present in Havona today and is growing in the super universes today. Of course, his growth is much less apparent than the growth of the Supreme.
But are they proportionate?
Ma'am, is the Supreme Being is 20% here? I would say that the ultimate is 1% here.
Oh.
Something like that. Those are crude.
Where's the rest of
the being is 80% unfinished. The ultimate is better than 99% unfinished. But there's some of the ultimate here, and there's some ultimate growth going on concurrently with the growth of the Supreme. There's some growth going on in the absolute, too. And that's even more attenuate. These things are going on all the time, on all levels. And that's why I think every now and then the architects of the Master Universe sit in the poker game through their deputy, a personalized adjuster. And I'll bet you this Verona deck was just about dropped his teeth when this happened. Yeah.
When did this Verona deck come in? When did this happen?
Well, this paper is dated. We'll see if we can find it. Long since. Now let's see what the date of this writing is. I don't think too long ago. Not long since. We'll get our date at the tail end. Not long before 1935 of Urantia time. Maybe it was during World War I. Who knows? Definitely the Regency was over by 1935.
Even though
by the time of the writing, these three personalized adjusters had left the planet.
Oh, I see.
This would fit in very nicely with World War I. That's not long since 1935, and their function would have been, by 1935, spoken of in the past tense. At the time of the writing, they weren't here anymore. But during their stay, they really had at it.
Most factories.
Well, they called it an emergency regency anyway, which
was... Yeah. These Verona Deck regencies intrigue me very, very much. Do you want to talk about them a little bit while we're on them? There's a couple of places that we can spot these. You know, if you look at page 1250, the introduction to Seraphic Planetary Government, I get an awful kick out of, they take inventory of seven reasons why this world is really offbeat. First of page 1250, first of all, we were a life modification sphere. Second, we got involved in the Lucifer Rebellion. Third, Adam defaulted. Fifth, the Creator Son bestowed himself here. And he carries the title Planetary Prince of Urantia. Sixth, we got a special relationship with 24 ex-natives, or... well, that isn't 100% true, acting as a board of directors. And to use a British term, one of their number is present every 100 years as a resident director. That's the English term for general manager, resident governor general. On this world, We did get some advantage because Mike Hill is planetary prince. I suspect he was the one that caused a divisional headquarters of the archangels to be located here. You wouldn't expect to find that on an inhabited world. But in locating that divisional headquarters here, we got a communication circuit, the archangel circuit. And we're not totally isolated.
Do you have any guess on when that might have come into being here?
Sometime after he left this world. Sometime during the last 1900 years. I would guess not long after he left. And then Machiavenna Melchizedek, who lived in the days of Abraham, has been designated as Michael's deputy, vicegerent planetary prince. That's our real inventory of offbeat characteristics. We didn't even start out as typical, and we have grown less and less typical with the passage of time. On page 1253, they talk about the Most High Observer. You see, way back in the days of the Planetary Rebellion, you know, Marvin likes to talk about the mansion worlds. I like to talk about the Planetary Rebellion. Because if the Urantia movement had certain features of the Roman Church, Van would be my patron saint. And I'll tell you why. The story of Van gave me the answer to my personal major philosophic problem on religion. I had always resisted religion because it seemed to me that when you embraced a religion, you tied a bandage around your eyes and groped forward mumbling, credo, credimus. You know, I believe, we believe. And I could never abdicate my intelligence and my judgment. And I could never reconcile this problem with what seemed to me to be a problem of faith and judgment until I read the story of Van, which to me is the most important single story in the Urantia book, because it enabled me to have faith. You see, if Van had had a bandage around his eyes and just said credo credimus, he would have gone along with the game, because Caligastia was his boss. Caligastia held a commission from Gabriel as planetary prince of Urantia. And in case Van had any doubt, which he did, he appealed to Lucifer. Now please remember, Lucifer was the highest universe administrator that Van had had any personal contact with. He was a Jerusalem citizen. And what was the answer to this appeal? A command for unquestioning obedience to Caligastia. And here's where I get the difference between the blindfold of belief and the liberation of faith. The papers make that distinction. Belief limits and faith liberates the soul. I imagine the reading of Lucifer's reply was a traumatic experience to Van. It was a hell of a shock. And I'll bet you he sat down and did some thinking.
Did he gasp for breath?
Right. And then he got up and he drew an indictment of Daligastia, Caligastia, and Lucifer, and appealed to the rulers of the constellation. And they promptly replied. But during the time of the transit of this reply between Edentia and Urantia and Devantia, the circuit supervisor on Salvington pulled a master switch, and this message was marooned in a relay center somewhere between here and Edentia. As the papers say, They never did get the darn thing out until recently. And so, where is Van? For 7 years, Van and his associates had to sweat it out. And this intrigues me. When did the Constellation government intervene? They did not intervene until every last free will creature on this world who understood the issue had made a decision. This didn't apply to evolutionary man. I don't think the average evolutionary man was at all involved in this rebellion, didn't even know it was happening. But all those physical and superphysical beings who understood the issue had to make a decision. And the minute that decision was made, and this was after 7 years of sweating it out, a Verondadek son arrived here and stripped the shoulder boards off Caligastia and seized authority on this planet. And ever since then, there's been a Verondadek here, not always an active authority. That's what they mean when they say, there is still resident on your ranch, a Verondadek son. But, yes?
On what early training did Van faith build, grow?
Well, let's see what the paper says.
Donation teaching.
No.
No, I'm wondering.
No.
I don't remember accurately enough about
the they talk about it in these papers. As far as I'm concerned, this is Saint Van, you know, to me. Because what he did answered my major problem with religion. They analyzed three people here. Yeah, page 757. Paragraph 3. Caligastia, with a maximum of intelligence and a vast experience in universe affairs, went astray. Embraced sin. Amidon, with a minimum of intelligence and utterly devoid of universe experience, remained steadfast in the service of the universe and in loyalty to his associate. Van utilized both mind and spirit in a magnificent and effective combination of intellectual determination and spiritual insight, thereby achieving an experiential level of personality realization of the highest attainable order. Mind and spirit, when fully united, are potential for the creation of superhuman values, even Marantia realities. And Van did this without the help of a thought adjuster. His adjuster was standing by on Jerusalem. Well, sure. He was one of the, Van was a Jerusalem citizen. Mansion World graduate. This Verondadek observer just plain can take over. He can seize planetary government at a time of grave crisis. And this has happened 33 times in the history of Urantia. Yes?
If Van were an ex-mortal, is there any evidence pointing towards the fact that he might have had experience on a rebellion-tested planet before?
No, even if he had, no. However, Van had some special, they had a real hard look at Van. There is this to be said. Yeah. Ben, you know, was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. That was his title. He was the chairman of the 10th Commission, which was the Supreme Court of the planet. It was the Court of Appeals for all of the 9 special commissions. Its powers were wide, being entrusted with all matters of earthly concern, not specifically assigned to the other groups. This selected corps had been approved for the Constellation Fathers of Edentia before they were authorized to assume the functions of the Supreme Court on Urantia. The other 9 commissions were selected on Jerusalem, but this 10th commission